Ready to go?
Yes, sir.
All right. I want to read something, and then we're going to do our two-minute meditation. This one's called Shaping. Potter at the wheel. From centering to finished pot. Form increases as options decrease. Softness goes to hardness. When a potter begins to throw a pot, she picks up a lump of clay, shapes it into a rougher sphere, and throws it onto the spinning potter's wheel. It may land off center, and she must carefully begin to shape it until it is a smoother cylinder. Then she works the clay, stretching and compressing it as it turns. First it is a tower, then it is like a squat mushroom. Only after bringing it up and down several times does she slowly squeeze the revolving clay until its walls rise from the wheel. She cannot go on too long, for the clay will begin to tire and then sag. She gives it the form she imagines, then sets it aside. The next day the clay will be leather hard, and she can turn it over to shape the foot. Some decoration may be scratched into the surface. Eventually, the bowl will be fired, and then the only options are the colors applied to it. Its shape cannot be changed. This is how we shape all situations in our lives. We must give them rough shape and then throw them down into the center of our lives. We must stretch and compress, testing the nature of things. As we shape the situation, we must be aware of what form we want things to take. The closer something comes to completion, the harder and more definite it becomes. Our options become fewer until the full impact of our creation is all that there is. Beauty or ugliness, utility or failure, comes from the process of shaping. 2 minute meditation.
Prayer.
Believe it or not, you're involved in a recreative process. You may be unaware of it. You may be unconscious to it. But on some level, you're in the shaping process right now. But like Brandon said in our first session, you may reject the experience altogether. And I'm a guy that believes when you cut off an experience in the middle of it, you're meant to have that experience. And for you to have that experience means you got to go all the way back to the beginning and have that entire experience again. As we shape the situation, we must be aware of what form we want things to take. The form in early recovery is the 12 steps. But if you commit to a life rooted in the 12 steps, you will eventually lose the form. The big book says what used to be the hunch or the occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. As you work these 12 steps, they become integrated into you at a cellular level. You will begin to live and breathe and eat the steps, and you won't even know you're doing it. They will just become a way of how you filter existence. It's one of the ways I filter existence is through these 12 steps. They have revolutionized my way of living and thinking. The closer something comes to completion, the harder and more definite it becomes. I am very definite today in how I attempt to live my life. The 12 steps are at the foundation of everything that I do. But the 12 steps have led me into so much more investigation into the spiritual realm. But the foundation, my modality and my vehicle for all of this is always rooted in the 12 steps. They've catapulted me into everything I've done outside of the steps. And yet to this day, and God willing, it will not change. Everything I do is always in conjunction with these 12 steps. There are things I do that are just as important as these 12 steps. But nothing is more important than these 12 steps, because they're my vehicle for God. I found God of my understanding and of my misunderstanding as a result of these 12 steps. Our options become fewer until the full impact of our creation is all that there is. And that's what I live with today. This is all that I have is as a result of being brought to this process. So I'm definite on what role it has to play in my life. So these are questions you have to ask for yourself. Are you willing to do this from here on? And yes, if you want what we have, you'll have to do it for the rest of your life.
It's so, like, there's another reading that we were cracking up about right before it came out of the same book. Once you really get on the spiritual path, you've got to really be cautious of what you share with people, because instead of being spirituality being a bringing people closer to you, it can force people away from you because they think you're nuts when you talk about some. And there's some 11 step practices that we do that you guys would be like, "What? What are you guys talking about?" But none of those practices could exist if we hadn't gone through the steps. Where you can go after you've done the steps in terms of spirituality, like, you'll hear us throwing hints out about it. Like, we intuitively know who we're reaching. It'll be weird. Like, we will be up here, and there'll be a guy that hasn't been paying attention all of tonight, most of tomorrow, and somewhere tomorrow, he'll send up a flare. And I mean, that's the only way I can describe it, is this person will go, I'll be looking over here, and all of a sudden I'll see something go over here, and I'll look, and there's somebody on this side of the room that just came online. We said something in just the right way that all of a sudden we got hooked up with them. Now, for a regular person, they don't see it. But when you've really cultivated this way of life, stuff comes at you kind of different. And we'll say it probably again, if this way of life, if drugs and alcohol did for you what they did for me, I've got to find something else that is that powerful and exciting to me today if you want me to stay here. And for most people, spirituality seems like a way of life that's boring and better than the best crack rock you've ever hit. Guaranteed. So, you guys are probably wondering, well, okay, so you've referenced a bunch of, Tarek referenced Joe, your buddy that you're friends with that doesn't really have to work the steps that hard. Well, how do you know which one you are, right? Would anybody like a way to they can figure out how bad they have alcoholism or drug addiction so that they know whether or not they have to be a mad dog or they can just kind of slack off? Anybody interested in finding out how to figure that out? Okay. I mean, for the rest of you that don't really care, does that mean that you're, like, not a mad dog?
Yeah, reject real quick. So, this group here tonight, you guys all may fall in three or four, but the rooms of AA and CA are filled with one, two, three, and four. And you'll understand what I'm talking about when Brandon's done.
Now, what the disclaimer I'm going to put on what we're getting ready to go through, this talks about a lot of the physical, material kind of stuff, okay? Just because these physical, material things don't happen to you doesn't mean you're not one of these. Because for a lot of us, the internal rot is worse than what our material outside shows, okay? So let's turn to page 108. Try to do these fast, but I'm going to do them twice because it's important to differentiate, and I'll show, and you'll understand why. So the bottom of page 108, we're looking at just alcohol right now. Just alcohol, no drugs, okay? So, is this you? Has this ever been you? Your husband may be only a heavy drinker. His drinking may be constant, or maybe heavy only on certain occasions. Maybe he spends too much money for liquor. It may be slowing him up mentally and physically, but he does not see it. Sometimes he is a source of embarrassment to you and his friends. He is positive he can handle his liquor, that it does him no harm, that drinking is necessary in his business. He would probably be insulted if he were called an alcoholic. This world is full of people like him. Some will moderate or stop altogether, and some will not. Of those who keep on, a good number will become true alcoholics after a while. Does this describe anybody in here? Alcohol. Okay? Cool. Okay. Two, your husband may be showing lack of control. He is unable to stay on the water wagon even when he wants to. He often gets entirely out of hand when drinking. He admits this is true, but is positive that he will do better. He has begun to try, with or without your cooperation, various means of moderating or staying dry. Maybe he is beginning to lose his friends. His business may suffer somewhat. He is worried at times and is becoming aware he cannot drink like other people. He sometimes drinks in the morning and through the day also to hold his nervousness in check. He is remorseful after serious drinking bouts and tells you he wants to stop. But when he gets over the spree, he begins to think once more how he can drink moderately next time. We think this person is in danger. These are the earmarks of a real alcoholic. Perhaps he can still tend to business fairly well. He has by no means ruined everything. As we say among ourselves, he wants to stop. Anybody? Okay, so a couple more. A couple more came online. So, basically, we had nobody in one. Some kind of partial hands. All right, so if you would like to draw a line here, this is where, to me, shit gets real. Okay? Three, this husband has gone much further than number two. Though once like number two, he became worse. His friends have slipped away. His home is a near wreck. He cannot hold a position. Maybe the doctor has been called in and the weary rounds of sanitariums and hospitals has begun. He admits he cannot drink like other people, but does not see why. He clings to the notion that he will yet find a way to do so. He may have come to the point where he desperately wants to stop, but cannot. His case presents additional questions, which we shall try to answer for you. You can be quite hopeful in a situation like that. Anyone? Yeah, this is where I live. Okay, this is where I am now. Question. So maybe the doctor has been called in, and the weary round of sanitariums and hospitals has begun. Who in here believes they're an alcoholic? Let's be a little more proud of what we got there. Okay. All right. So does anybody know what sanitariums are? Yeah, psych institutions. Okay. When this book was written, when you were an alcoholic or an addict, they would send you to the loony bin because for you to continue to do over and over and over what you've done over and over and over again, you've got to be crazy. Okay? Short of three hospitals in the world at the time, there was one in New York, one somewhere over in France, and I don't know where the other one was. Nobody wanted alcoholics and addicts. They just didn't want them. So they sent them to the loony bin. You know what they call those places now? Treatment centers.
Bridges of Hope.
You now have a place to go. So, how many type 3s we got out there? A couple more now? Starting to realize maybe the gravity of the situation?
So, real quick. So as he's reading all this, I'm reflecting on my experience with alcohol. I'm not quite a 3. For alcohol, I'm somewhere between a 2 and a 3. All right, and so when I start to look at what my master truly is, I start to look at this line in the book that says, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. All right, so he's focusing on alcohol right now. That's all you should be looking at if you fit these descriptions. Then he's going to go back and do it again, and we're going to look at drugs. Okay, I'm a guy that believes very few people are both alcoholic and drug addict. I'm primarily a cocaine addict. But I have some mental and physical with alcohol. I've definitely got the physical. I have 17 years of drinking to look at. But when it comes to what used to hunt me like a piece of prey, I'm talking anytime I was clean for like 12, 14, 16 hours, 24 hours, the first substance that came looking for me was most of the time, almost 9 out of 10 times it's going to be cocaine. That other time would be whiskey. But I didn't have a mental obsession for any of the other drugs that I loved to do. I loved Oxycontin. I loved doing boy. I never had a mental obsession. When heroin and Oxycontin was gone, okay. The only time it really came into my life when it was convenient. I turned into seek and destroy mode for crack, and that was it. So as you continue to listen to Brandon break this down, start really looking at what you are. It's important to know what you are and what your truth is. This whole thing is built on foundation of truth.
4, you may have a husband for whom you completely despair. He has been placed in one institution after another. He is violent or appears definitely insane when drunk. Sometimes he drinks on the way home from the hospital. Perhaps he has had delirium tremens. Doctors may shake their head and advise you to have him committed. Maybe you have already been obliged to put him away. Okay, who in here ever drank on the way home from treatment? Who in here is a type 4? Same hand should be up. If you're not figuring this out, I'm trying to make it easy on you. So, okay. So that's alcohol, guys, right? Well, there were a lot of hands that weren't raised in this room. So are alcoholism and drug addiction the same? Okay. And here's why this is important. I'll tell you another reason in a minute. I was talking to a guy that I sponsor, and he raised his hand and he says, I'm an alcoholic and an addict. My name is... Next time I talked to him on the phone, I said, you said you were an alcoholic and an addict. What's up with that? He's like, well, I'm an alcoholic and an addict. I'm like, when did that start? And he said, I've always been an alcoholic and an addict. And I was like, really? Explain more. He said, well, this last time when I relapsed, when I was drinking, I was doing some DMT and some other stuff. And I said, okay. So when that ran out, did you go get more? No. Okay. The next day, did you think that you needed to go get more of that? No. Okay. Well, when you ran out of alcohol, what'd you do? Oh, I went to the store and got more. Okay. The next day, what'd you do? I had to go get more. Like, okay, so understand, in order to be an alcoholic, I have a physical craving that we'll talk about a little bit. That once I start, I don't decide when I stop. It does. And I have a mental obsession, which means that when I stop, I cannot stay stopped. So does that exist for you around alcohol? If the answer is yes to both of those, and there's a part in the book that says either or, but to me, I think you got to have both. That's Brandon's personal opinion. Once you start, you cannot stop drinking. And once you stop, you cannot stay stopped. It's real clear to me, you're an alcoholic. You figure it out for yourself, I'll tell you. If you got that, you're an alcoholic. Okay? If no other substance does that to you, that you repeatedly go back to, you are not an addict. Okay? Let's go back to page 108. We'll look at these again. One, your husband may be only a heavy drug user. You got to do this because it always sounds fake when I try to do it because I'm not an addict. So he can throw some stuff in there that makes it sound like it's legit.
All right. One, your husband may only be a recreational drug user. His using may be constant or may be heavy only on certain occasions. Perhaps he spends too much money on cocaine or some Oxycontin or some painkillers. It may be slowing him up mentally and physically, but he does not see it. Sometimes he is a source of embarrassment to you and his friends. He is positive he can handle his drugs on the weekends, that it does him no harm, that using is necessary in social environments. He would probably be insulted if he were called an addict. This world is full of people like him. Some will moderate or stop altogether, and some will not. Of those who keep on, a good number will become true, real addicts after a while.
Who we got?
Not fit me.
Okay. Next.
Your husband may be showing lack of control, for he is unable to stay clean even when he wants to. He often gets entirely out of hand when using. He gets psychotic. He looks through the blinds. He's unplugging appliances. He's hiding in his closet.
He's taking shit apart. He's putting it back together.
He admits this is true, but is positive that he will do better. He has begun to try, with or without your cooperation, various means of moderating or staying clean. Maybe he's only smoking pot and he's only eating Valiums. He's trying to stay away from the cocaine and the boy. Maybe he's beginning to lose his friends. His business may suffer somewhat. He's not showing up to work on time. He's calling out sick a lot. He's worried at times and is becoming aware that he can't use drugs like other people. He sometimes uses in the morning and through the day, doing some key bumps in the bathroom at work, to hold his nervousness in check. He is remorseful after serious using bouts and psychotic episodes and tells you he wants to stop. But when he gets over his spree, he begins to think once more how he can use recreationally starting Thursday night. And he'll be done Sunday night so he can go to work on Monday. We think this person is in danger. These are the earmarks of a real addict. Perhaps he can still tend to business fairly well. He has by no means ruined everything. As we say among ourselves, he wants to want to stop.
Who we got? All right, now, what's also important about this is I read it very diligently the way that the book read it for alcohol. What Tarek has started doing, what you'll start to see us do, is we start changing the words in the book to make it come alive. Okay? And the reason why I wanted him to do this is because he can throw those things in there that he's speaking addict. When I speak addict, I sound like your teacher trying to teach you about what drugs do to you. You know, it just doesn't sound right, right? Like, and I guess I'll insert this story here. We're sitting there outside our meeting one night. And Tarek and a bunch of guys are in a circle, and they got in this fascinating conversation about talking about all the different things that they smoked out of, right? And they're talking about like smoking out of light bulbs, and some guy talks about a potato, and I'm like sitting there listening to him going, fascinating. And Tarek goes, everybody, wait, look at Brandon. And everybody looks at me, and he goes, he has no fucking idea what we're talking about. Because I didn't. So you get me in the room with an addict trying to talk addict. At some point in time, I may convince him he's got something going on, but I am not speaking his language. You give me 2 minutes with an alcoholic. He's like, man, I want to party with you, right? That's why identification is very important. And again, I'll tell you another reason why in just a minute.
Number three, this husband has gone much further than husband number two. Though once like number two, he became worse. His friends have slipped away. His home is near wreck. He's pawned everything and he cannot hold a job. Maybe the doctor has been called in the weary round of treatment centers and detoxes has begun. He admits he cannot recreationally use drugs like other people, but does not see why. He clings to the notion that he will yet one way find a way to be a weekend warrior. He may have to come to the point where he desperately wants to stop but cannot. His case presents additional questions which we'll try to answer for you. We can be quite helpful of a situation like this.
So what's up? Who we got? Did we lose some of you? Okay.
So this is number four. You may have a husband of whom you completely despair. He has been placed in one treatment center after another. He's 35 years old and he's been to treatment 20 times. He is violent or psychotic. He's twitchy and appears definitely insane when he's high. Sometimes he gets high on the way home from a hospital.
Sometimes he jumps out of a moving car.
Perhaps he's now having psychotic episodes that last for days on end after smoking crack for 3 days. Doctors may shake their heads and advise him to have him committed for some mental stability.
He's got an ankle bracelet and drug testing, and he's still...
I gotta tell y'all a story. I had a guy that came to my program with an ankle bracelet, and he disappeared one night. And he tried to convince us he hadn't gone to smoke crack. And so we looked up the ankle monitor, like where it had gone the night before. And he was like in like the crack traps. And we sat him down in the office and we're like, dude, is there something you want to tell us? He's like, man, I'm clean, man. I don't know why I'm failing this urine test, man. And I like turned the computer to him. I was like, dude, this is where you were at last night with that ankle bracelet. Anyway, fascinating, right?
Okay, so, all right. Now, notice that we distinguish between the alcoholic and addict. Notice that I also told you that there's a difference between a type 1 and 2 and a type 3 and 4. If you, and you got to be honest with yourself here. Usually, when people share their war stories, they always want to be a 3 or 4. When we go through this exercise, they always want to be a 1 or 2. Kind of weird, isn't it? I want to sound worse than I am to everybody so I sound cool, but when it comes down to really diagnosing the problem, I want the lesser. Okay, so you figure it out. But if you're a type 1 or 2, you may leave here and be okay. You might do some inventory, maybe make amends to the family, get a service position of making coffee. You can rock it on. Okay? And that works for a lot of people in the meetings. They can do that because they're a type 1 or 2. The problem is us type 3s and 4s try to compare our experience to the 1s and 2s. And we see what they do and we think we can do that too. And guess what? Drunk. Every time. High. Every time. So, the good news is, if you're a type 3 and 4, you're fucked. And the really good news is, there's a really simple way to fix that. And that's what we're here to share with you. If you're type 1 or 2, hopefully we'll be entertaining to you.
One of the things that happens as you get closer and closer to a type 4, your options are reduced. When you're a 1 and 2, you got a lot of options looking at you. I think you spend a lot of time in step 0 when you're a 1 and a 2. You guys ever heard of step 0? Step 0 is that wonderfully horrific time between your last drink or drug and when you finally make a commitment to go through with the program of action as outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Step 0 just goes round and round until you burn off all the alternatives and you're faced with two options. Live life on a spiritual basis or die the crackhead death. Live life on a spiritual basis or die the heroin addict death. Live life on a spiritual basis or die the alcoholic death.
Whenever there's the third option,
yeah.
Another job, girlfriend, maybe some marijuana. Yeah. Maybe if I just smoke some good pot, take the edge off, I won't need to do some stuff. That's an option.
We always think if we solve all these other problems, it'll solve the problem of alcohol and drugs. If I just get this right job, if I just get all this paper taken care of, if I get this right woman, if I get the right external circumstances, right, everything will solve itself. And what ends up happening is we destroy all that stuff in the process of doing that. It's like we're driving down the street and we're throwing all these broken problems in the back seat, and then we slam the brakes on, and that shit all comes flying out of the back seat into the front seat. Right? That's typically what it looks like as you're walking in the front door at the Bridges of Hope.
It's like the crazy scientist trying to generate a source of light out of doing all this stuff. And then Tarek and Brandon walk in and flip on the light switch and say, you can just do this, it's easier. All right, so why is it important to differentiate between alcoholic and addict, crackhead, heroin addict? I'll tell you why. I am an alcoholic, as I've said multiple times. Real clear on that. Smoked pot twice, ate mushrooms once, and did something else. I don't even know what it was, but I had no effect out of any of that stuff. None of those things touched me. But alcohol worked wonders for me. So there's this guy, we'll call him Nick, because that's his name. And Nick came to me. Nick was an alcoholic. Nick also liked to snort heroin. So Nick was on some, I don't even know what it is. He was on some meds to get him off heroin that was getting him fucked up just the same. And I saw him one night, and he was kind of nodding out, and he was just not doing really well. And I told him, I said, dude, you look like shit. I was like, either you're fucked up or you're getting ready to be fucked up. And he said, you don't know me. And I was like, no, I'm just telling you what I'm seeing. Something's not right with you. You're off. Well, we had another conversation the next day where, you know, I was talking to him. I kicked him in the head a little bit, tried to motivate him to do some stuff. And it was pretty clear that he said to me, I'm going through withdrawals from this medicine, and it's fucking me up. And what I said to him is, I don't have any experience with that, withdrawals from medicine, but there's a lot of people in my network that do. Let me get you hooked up with them. All he heard was, I don't have any experience with that. I'm different from you. This won't work for me. That's not what I said. That's what he heard. So in that moment, his mind slapped shut. The steps will not work for me because I don't have what he has. Had Tarek give him a call. Tarek talks to him. He decides he's going to go to the church and he's going to try religion. And he says, if that doesn't work, I'll just come back. Keep coming back. I'll just come back. Tarek says, you assume you get to come back. It may not be up to you. He was dead 2 weeks later. Okay? So, that stuff that we spew in meetings of keep coming back perpetuates this idea that I get to do this multiple times, can screw it up multiple times and still make it back. It's not up to you guys. Keep coming back works until it doesn't work and you're dead. There's somebody sitting in this room right now that thinks, this is great, I'm going to go try my way, and when that doesn't work, I'll come back. Not up to you. You get some of that funky shit that takes you out, you ain't coming back. Why it's so important for you to understand what you have is from a sponsorship standpoint, so that you can communicate the best and clearest message to the person that you're talking to. I will not sponsor addicts unless they've been through the steps already. At that point in time, that differentiation between me and them has been separated. Not because I can't connect with them, it's because their mind can twist what I say and say they're different. So if you're going to sponsor So if you're going to stay clean and sober, if you're going to sponsor, you better get real clear on what you got. Because I don't have any guilt over that. I did not kill that man. He made a series of choices that took him out. But it taught me a very valuable lesson of understanding why it is important to know what I got. An alcoholic is not an addict. A crackhead is not a heroin addict. Different. Every time. So.
All right. Wonderful. Let's go to the doctor's opinion. Turn to XXVI.
Does everybody have a fourth edition in here? What's that?
Everybody's got four.
Everybody, okay. Because if you've got a third edition, it's two pages less. So,
we're going to go to the second full paragraph. It says the doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol and or drugs interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers and drug users, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. So, addicts and alcoholics typically suffer from a great deal of shame and regret. Who in here has kids? So I've sponsored men over the years that have children. And I've seen a lot of them struggle with regret and shame because they're absent from their children's lives because of their addiction to drugs and or alcohol. And I've heard a lot of them say that I can't believe I keep smoking crack over seeing my kids. I'm not showing up to pick them up because I'm off smoking crack or shooting dope. I vanish. I miss my visitation. I mean, all kinds of things. Who in here has experience with that? Almost every father that in here. So, if you truly understand out of experience what the physical craving really says, you should not have any guilt and shame. We have guilt and shame because we think we could have done differently. But the physical craving, once activated, it's like activating a fire that burns inside of you. And the fire burns out when the fire wants to burn out. You don't get to decide. You and I don't get to decide when the fire burns out. The monster wakes up. And the monster goes to sleep when the monster wants to go to sleep.
Anybody have experience with that in here?
I mean, we all get. If somebody, if we're on a run and somebody tries to stop our run and we still got some money, they better get the fuck out of the way. Right?
You still got some things of value around the house that you can hock?
It's like getting your head in a tiger's mouth. You're going where the fucking tiger wants to go. Okay? That's the best way I can describe it. So I'm going to give you a personal story of mine. I'm in Las Vegas in 2005. I didn't sleep 2 days before leaving for Vegas, partying with my buddy. We stayed up the entire time in Vegas, missed a couple of flights, me and my girlfriend on the way back to Atlanta, and I want to keep this party going. Okay? Been smoking crack and DMT for days on end. We get back to Atlanta, we get to the house. Now, my mom hasn't seen me in quite some time. She doesn't know if I'm alive or dead. I'm not picking up my phone anytime she calls. We get back to the house, and I'm trying to get some stuff together to go downtown in Atlanta, and my mom comes to the house, and the monster is awake, and that fire is burning, and she tries to get between me and where I gotta go. I said some things to my mother that no son should ever say to his mom, but more importantly, I picked up a Dirt Devil vacuum cleaner, and I threw it at my mom's head as hard as I could, so she would get the fuck out of the way. I had a great deal of shame and regret and guilt around that. Until a man sat me down and took me through the doctor's opinion And he told me, once that monster wakes up and that fire starts burning, all bets are off, brother. Everything that you do, you're not truly responsible for. You couldn't have done any different. But when you go to your mom to make that amends, you can't tell your mom you woke up some monster or you had some fire burning. You can't tell your mom you have an abnormal physical craving. And once you start, you cannot stop. And anything that tries to get in your way will be run over. All your mom wants to hear is how much you regret it. She wants to hear how you're willing to do anything to make it right. And she wants you to let her talk about how it made her feel. That's all your mom cares about. But for you to get free of guilt and shame, you need to get through your thick skull what it means to have an abnormal physical reaction to this substance. It means once you start, all bets are off. If you truly see that in your experience, you'll begin to drop the guilt and the shame because you're going to see you could not have done any different. But here's the really cool part. Having the capacity to treat people that love us that way becomes unacceptable. And from a place of unacceptance, I became willing to never be in a position where I'm going to hum a dirt devil vacuum cleaner in my mom's head. And I haven't. It is unacceptable for me to show up that way in life. But I know I've got to take a serious, I have to take a specific course of action to stay in a position where I don't do that to people. That's why it's important. That's why that sentence at the end of that paragraph, it explains many things which we could not otherwise account for. You know, for years when I missed holiday parties and family events and parents' birthdays and brothers' birthdays, there was a part of me that thought I was just a piece of shit with a moral compass that was broken. Once a man sat down and explained to me that once I start, I cannot stop, and wherever it takes me, it's where it's going to take me, I began to see that I could not have done any different. It does not relieve me of the responsibility to make the amends and to not bring it up either. Hey, I harmed you. This is what I did. Do you want to talk about it? What do I got to do to make it right? That's all they want to hear. They don't want me to explain and break down the physical craving to them. They don't care about that. Very important, because so many of us suffer from this guilt and shame. And I'm convinced. You cannot convince me otherwise. The only reason we have guilt and shame is because there's a part of us that thinks we could have done different. Turn the page for me. Bottom of the page. It says, men and women, Tarek and Brandon, drank and used drugs, essentially, because they liked the effect produced by alcohol and drugs. The feeling or the sensation or the effect is so elusive and hard to hold on to, and while they admit it hurts them at times, Tarek and Brandon cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. It's killing us, and we still believe we're getting something from it. To Tarek and Brandon, their alcoholic and addict lives seem the only normal ones. We've been doing it for so long. They are uneasy, restless, irritable, easily annoyed, and discontented unless they can again experience the same sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks or a few key bumps or a few Valium. Drinks and drugs which they see other people taking without the same consequences. After Tarek and Brandon give in to the desire, and so many of us do, this fire is activated, the monster wakes up, the phenomenon of craving develops, and they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful in the hotel room with that little tear coming out of the eye, smelling like dog shit, fingers all black. They hadn't taken a shower in 5 days. They look in the mirror and they make this firm resolution not to smoke crack cocaine again.
Not doing that again.
And then Tarek repeats over and over the same experiment. And unless Tarek can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope for his recovery. Psychic change. Do you believe there's another solution? I don't believe I have any other solution. This was my story as I read it. See, what happens to us is we experience that restlessness, that irritability, and that discontent. And then the mental powerlessness shows up. The restlessness and the irritability and the discontent is the breeding ground for the mental obsession, right? We can't exist in that space for very long. We have to have an effect produced. It's like a spring in your chest that just gets tighter and tighter and tighter. And the spring has to be relieved. The pressure has to be relieved. And if you're not getting the relief and the ease and the comfort from this process, you best bet your mind's going to take you back to what did give you ease and comfort in the past, because it's going to hope to God that perhaps by some miracle I have some control this time.
Maybe it'll work.
And so we the big book calls it the peculiar mental twist. The blind spot comes, and then we take the first drink or drug, boom, we activate the monster. The fire lights up, and we experience the physical powerlessness of addiction and alcohol. Torture.
And what's interesting to me is, I don't know if addicts have the same thing, but for alcoholics, every single one of them I've ever talked to has this. You don't even have to put it in your body for you to start feeling the ease and comfort. How many times have you been having that shitty ass day and you're like, screw it, I'm just going to go get hammered. I'm just going to go get all tore up. You get to the store. Maybe you get to the crack man. You get it in your possession. Haven't even put it in your body yet. And now I can breathe. Something's going on. If it's not even in me yet and I'm feeling better, something's going on, huh? Isn't that weird? You guys ever observe that in yourself? Head into the crack man's house, you get a little bit of just feeling better knowing I'm getting it, right? Don't even have to have it yet. Or you found the thing to pawn. Oh, yes! I can take this to the pawn shop and now, yes! I'm starting to feel a little better. Anybody? Okay. Just making sure we're still alive out there.
So we experience the mental powerlessness. We activate the craving. We become physically powerless. We don't know when the ride's going to be over. We go through all the mental, the torture, the mental torture, the physical torture. And the spree comes to an end, and we come out of it guilt-ridden. And we come out of it remorseful. We make that firm resolution, and we're good for a few days. And guess what? I start to feel uneasy. I start to feel easily annoyed. I get this sense that I'll never be satisfied. I'm restless. I'm irritable. I'm judgmental. I don't care what you describe it as. It starts all over again. I can't sit in my skin. I need an effect produced. What am I going to do? I can't. These meetings don't work. I'm not working any steps. I'm just going to meetings.
Derek, you should just think, think, think. And play. Just think the drink through. Play the tape through. If you do all of that, then you'll be okay.
But my tape ends with a 20 rock on the top of my stem. That's how my tape player is broken. And most addicts and alcoholics that I've run across have a broken tape player too. The big book says we'll be taken to a place where we don't think at all. So how the hell do we think the drink or the drug through?
Supposed to call three people? Call them a dealer, the whore, and the hotel, right? You ain't calling your sponsor or somebody in your network. Or if you are calling your sponsor, you're going, don't answer, don't answer, don't answer, don't answer. Yes, okay, he didn't answer. All right, so who else can I call? Don't answer, don't answer. Okay, I guess I'm supposed to get high. You've already made the decision.
The other really good way to see the physical when I'm taking somebody through the steps is at the bottom of that page, XXIX. You guys see where it says, I do not hold with those who believe that addiction and alcoholism are entirely problems of mental control. I've had many men who had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal, which was to be settled on a certain date in their favor. They took a drink or a drug a day or so prior to the date, and they activated the fire or the monster, the phenomenon of craving, and at once, it became paramount to all other interests. So the important appointment, which like was picking up my kids for the weekend, was not met. These men were not drinking or using to escape. They're drinking and using to overcome a craving beyond their mental control.
So how this showed up for me one time is we just bought this big, nice house. Lots of bedrooms. Everybody's coming over for Thanksgiving, right? Not drinking to escape. My job, only job I had on this Thanksgiving, was to get up, turn the oven on, and put the bird in the oven, right? Had to do this at like 5 o'clock very specifically so that it could be done at a very specific time because my sister and her family were coming over to our house to have Thanksgiving dinner with us, and then they had to jet across town to go have Thanksgiving dinner with her husband's family. So, like, this was very neatly orchestrated that at a very specific time, turn the oven on, put the bird in the oven. That's it. Brandon's whole job. So Brandon starts drinking. PlayStation, you know, we're playing a game, drinking a little more. Man, I need to make sure I wake up. So literally, guys, I've set like 5 alarms in the basement. And just going. I wake up at like 8 o'clock with all these alarms going off and my wife standing over me, yelling at me, explaining to me that I have now ruined Thanksgiving. The first Thanksgiving in the house ruined it for everybody. I wasn't drinking to escape. But I had ignited something in me that made me go until, you know, I had to turn the oven on at like 5. I think I remembered seeing the clock around 4. Something happened between 4 and 5. Wasn't escaping. Look at your own experience and find out where those stories show up for you.
Important engagements is the best way to see if you've got physical powerlessness. All the places you and I were supposed to be, being at work on time sober is actually an important engagement.
Well-paying job.
Yeah.
Where you've been written up. They've threatened to fire you if you show up drunk or high again.
And I get fired. It's easy for me to see the loss of control. I just got to look at all the important engagements. I miss so many things. And those of you that have children, the fact that you can't stop and get to your kids, it should be really crystal clear to you that you've lost physical power. You are physically powerless over whatever the substance is. And that's never, there's the only remedy we have for that is complete abstinence. But if it was the only problem, Nancy Reagan's Just Say No to Drugs or Alcohol would have worked, right? This is the drugs, this is the alcohol, it's not in my body, just say no.
Just draw a red circle around it, put a line through it, we're done.
But it's not. So we're going to get into that a little bit more. We're going to take a 15-minute break.